Today is Monday, June 5th. We're going to be talking about the rest of the blood information, heart anatomy, and then save some time for Q&A for exam one. And on page 28, we're just going to hit the whole topic of blood clotting from the top down once more, just like we've never covered it before. And I wanted to start off with the very first phase here, which is vascular spasms. So, you know, bleeding can be internal and bleeding can be external. We often think about bleeding as being something we can see, but if a vessel is cut or if a vessel ruptures, then the first step to help stem blood loss is vascular spasms. So what happens to the blood vessel? Constricts, good. How does this prevent blood loss? Yeah, decreases blood flow through, good. So it's technically a squeezing of the vessel, and this vasoconstriction limits blood flow through that area, and that is one attempt at helping to limit blood loss. So squeezing the vessel or putting pressure like we sometimes do can help to stem the blood loss through that vessel. Now, normally, platelets do not stick to the inside lining of vessels. That would be a bad thing if they were to stick. So when a vessel is ruptured, the first thing that we see happen is the vascular spasms. The second thing we see happen is a platelet plug formed. So what are platelets clinging to?
Damaged
side of that vessel. Oftentimes, it's collagen fibers that are hanging down, and those vessels will cling on to those damaged collagen fibers and stick. Some platelets will release a chemical called serotonin, and serotonin is a help message. It says to other platelets, come help me. I'm clogging up this damaged vessel. So the more serotonin is released, the more platelets come and cling to the site. They in turn release serotonin that causes even more platelets to rush to the site. What kind of feedback mechanism is this?
Positive.
It's positive, good. What is the goal?
Stop
bleeding, right. So normally those platelets will cling to whatever's in that vessel, and you know, toilet paper, Kleenexes, other things of that sort, they're not picky. They'll cling to whatever you let them stick to. So that's why it's important for gauze and bandages to have a chemical on there that inhibits those platelets from clinging to them, because goodness, nobody wants to pull off a bandage and remove that platelet plug. That's about where we were in class on Wednesday of last week. We didn't get to the final step, which is forming a gel-like clot. So let's kind of go through the details of coagulation just to make sure we hit all the points here. If you read the textbook, it's very much in detail about various factors. They're numbered in Roman numerals from 1 to 10, and these factors are involved in conversions from one chemical to the next. It is a very complicated step, but the ultimate goal is to form a clot called a thrombus, okay? And a thrombus is a gel-like consistency. No longer do we want liquid blood around the site of the wound. We want something that's a little more solid and prevents blood from escaping. So a thrombus is, in fact, a clot, and you can sometimes see it, especially if it's an external wound. So how do we get to the formation of a clot? We have chemicals known as prothrombin and thrombin. Those both have the word thromb in there. What does thromb tell you?
Clot.
Clot, yeah. So prothrombin converts to thrombin. Thrombin allows for the conversion of fibrinogen into fibrin. And once again, fibrinogen has the G-E-N suffix. What does that term mean? Start, form, build new, something of that sort. So fibrinogen is the inactive protein that's floating through our blood plasma. You need the conversion of these factors and of prothrombin to thrombin to convert fibrinogen to fibrin. I know this sounds like a mess, and it really is. There's a whole bunch of chemicals reacting together, and it's a domino effect. You turn on one thing, it turns on another, but the ultimate goal is the formation of fibrin. Fibrin is what helps to turn your blood from a liquid state to a gel-like state. Now pause here just in case anybody wants to copy notes or snap a picture. Liquid state to gel state, that's right. Yeah, that thrombus is what you want. It's more like a gel-like solid instead of a liquid running blood. I'm just checking to see if anybody is still using the slide. I'm checking for heads bobbing up and down. Y'all good? Okay. So I'd like to show you this picture. It's a really cool one because you've got the fibrin mesh network here. I kind of think of this as a fishing net. You know, the blood cells are trapped in it. But more than that, it's turning this whole blood cell and its surrounding plasma into a gel-like substance. So it's not just trapping the blood cell, it's making an impenetrable wall so that no more blood can escape and leak out of the vessel. So when we think about red blood cells and bloody scabs, I know it's a gross thought, you know, they're red because of all those red blood cells that are trapped in that area. And this is an actual picture of red blood cells, and it looks like they're trapped in spider webs. That is the fibrin mesh network that helps to turn your blood from liquid to gel. So really cool stuff there. As this continues to dry, it becomes a dry scab, and you may notice that as the scab heals, what happens to the skin around that scab? It dries out, right? Give it about a week. If you've got a pretty major scab, have you ever noticed how the skin puckers and pulls? So what is happening around that scab? Healing, yeah. So as the skin re-knits back together and as the vessel regrows its lining, the skin will pucker. You may in fact feel some itching as that skin is repairing itself. And eventually that scab is going to fall off and be gone, which is of course really important because you don't need a scab or a clot to remain either inside your vessel or blocking that blood flow. Okay, so about midway down your worksheet, let me give you the blanks there to fill in. A couple of things you need in order for blood to clot properly: vitamin K and calcium. So vitamin K is something you absorb through your digestive tract. It is pulled into your bloodstream. If you have anything that impairs absorption of vitamin K, you can then reduce blood clotting. You may know about anticoagulant drugs. Some of those drugs block vitamin K's action as part of the clotting mechanism. And so certain drug manufacturers warn against eating green leafy vegetables for that reason. So if you're taking anticoagulant and you increase your intake of leafy greens, you're basically fighting what the drug is trying to do by inhibiting clotting. So people with heart problems, like AFib, for instance, may take a blood thinner. A blood thinner is nothing more than an anticoagulant, and a lot of those drugs actually interfere with these kinds of clotting mechanisms, say calcium or vitamin K. Let's think back to our endocrine system. What hormones help to regulate blood calcium levels? Good. Calcitonin and PTH. Which one of those two raises blood calcium?
PTH,
right. So there again, we've got to rely on hormones working the calcium to make sure that blood clots correctly. So we've got a loop here of interconnectedness among all these parts. I did want to mention to you what blood serum is, just, you know, because the word is very commonly used. It technically is what's in the blood without red blood cells, white blood cells, platelets, and especially without fibrinogen. If you want just blood plasma, why should you take out the fibrinogen? What happens if you let it sit for 3 to 5 minutes?
It clots,
yeah. So that's why if we want to store blood for any length of time, we either have to use a chemical that stops the conversion of fibrinogen to fibrin, or we have to remove it from the blood altogether. So, you know, it's an important part for clotting, but doesn't work very well if you're going to store that that blood for any length of time. Okay. Down near the bottom of your page, I do want to mention this issue here of fibrinolysis. Let's break the word down. What is fibrin? What is it doing for us? Clotting, good. And what about lysis? Yeah, breakdown, rupture, dissolve, all those kind of give you the right idea. So we are breaking down the clot, which is fibrin, and that allows for us to remove the clot from inside a vessel. Do you see any long-term problems of leaving clots inside vessels after they've healed? What can they do?
Yep.
You can block blood flow, right? Okay, and if you block blood flow, then you've got major issues, especially if it's a vital vessel. So a thrombus happens to be a stationary clot that persists after healing has taken place. And then if it moves, it's an embolism or an embolus, right? So moving clots can head to some vital organs and cause big problems. If you have a pulmonary embolism, to which organ has that clot moved? Good. You can have a brain embolism, right? So, of course, they can move there as well. So we want to avoid having these embolus on the move because they can hit those vital organs and cause blockages there. So if somebody is known to have routinely formed thrombi or embolisms, what kind of medication would you give that person to prevent them from forming clots? Blood thinner, good. And is a blood thinner actually making your blood less viscous?
No.
No. So what is it actually doing? Blocking the clotting process, right. So there are numerous blood thinner anticoagulants on the market. They all target some specific part of that third step, which is forming the gel-like clot. We, in fact, have quite a few new blood thinners. Some old ones are like Coumadin and Warfarin, but some of those new ones like Eliquis and Pradaxa, good gosh, haven't... Xarelto, yeah. Some of those don't have reversal drugs, which is kind of scary. Some of those older drugs can be stopped. So what that means is if you're overly bleeding or if you're bleeding out, they can stop them. But some of those newer drugs are still working on those kinds of reversal drugs. So yeah, I just want to make sure that we all knew that blood thinners are not in fact thinning your blood or making it more runny or less viscous, but in fact stopping the clotting process. So we actually make in our own bodies something similar to Coumadin or Warfarin. It's called heparin, and you actually make that by your own vessels to help thin the blood. So it's kind of cool that we are our own source of a blood thinner. But nonetheless, there's a lot of drugs in the market, including aspirin, that are preventing blood clotting from forming. All right, so just checking, I know there's a lot of blanks in the bottom of this page. Did you find an answer for all of those blanks? Do you need help with any of those blanks in the bottom of your page?
The last one.
The last one. Okay, so why or how are thrombi and embolisms related to fibrinolysis? Those are when the clot does not break down, right? So if you have a thrombus or an embolus, then you probably didn't have fibrinolysis, right? Okay, so a failure of fibrinolysis can lead to a thrombus or an embolus. Okay, so yeah, failure of fibrinolysis can lead to a thrombus or an embolus. Failure of fibrinolysis can lead to a thrombus or embolus. So we're actually full circle. We've wrapped ourselves back to blood typing once again. Just checking to see if you had any questions on our blood clotting information, anything on blood typing. Okay, so the test on Wednesday runs through page 34. So it's hard to tell you this, but listen with one ear for the next hour and let it float through your brain with the other ear. What we're going to do is heart. It's not on test number one. It is on test number two. But I just wanted to make sure that we stay on pace with our content. So I'd like to cover just a little bit of heart information, starting on page 35. And then I'll save you from at least 2:30 till 3 so that you can have time for Q&A for our first exam. I want to leave you at least that much time to ask whatever questions you need. So starting here on page 35, this information is found on test number 2, not on test 1. I'm just going to get you a little bit into heart anatomy. Chapters 18, well, actually 17 and 18, are both cardiovascular system, and cardiovascular includes not only cardio heart, but also vascular and vessels. So our focus now is going to be just on the heart, and we know the heart's job is to pump blood, while the vessel's function is to transport that blood around the body. So we're going to kind of deal with these two chapters in conjunction with one another. Let's talk about the location and size and shape of the heart. The human heart is, on average, about the size of your fist. So those models in lab are a little bigger than your average human heart size. Where is the heart located? What cavity? Thoracic cavity, good. It is in a special little region of your thoracic cavity. This area right in here between the ribs is called what?
Mediastinum.
Mediastinum, good. And I just want to tell you that there's more in the mediastinum than just the heart. There's also the esophagus back here. We've got the tubes passing into the lungs. And, of course, we've got some major vessels coming off the heart that are in this snug little compartment called the mediastinum. If you break the word down, what is media?
Middle.
Middle. Good. So it's right smack dab in the middle of your chest cavity. The heart sits almost dead center, about a half of an inch skewed to the left-hand side of your thoracic cavity, but, you know, it is pretty much smack dab in the middle of your thoracic cavity. We can also see that right here underneath the sternum is where we see the apex of the heart situated. The base of the heart is all these blood vessels poking off the top side of that heart model. Okay, so when we look at it this way, once again, the apex is the pointed portion. It, in fact, points towards your left hip, and the base is all of these blood vessels that are situated towards your right shoulder. So a lot of times people get the incorrect notion that their heart is on the left side of their thoracic cavities because they feel the apex and the pumping ventricles on the left side. But, you know, in reality, yeah, it's more or less center. What is the muscle that sits up underneath the heart?
Diaphragm,
good. So that subtends both heart and, of course, lungs there. All right, let's talk about the coverings of the heart. Okay, so around the outside of the heart is a layer called the fibrous pericardium. Fibrous makes me think of a tough outer layer, and that's exactly what you want to have in mind. The fibrous pericardium is a tough outer covering. Now, the fibrous pericardium is anchored to a layer of serous pericardium. Back in Bio-210, you probably talked about serous membranes, and they're always composed of how many layers? Two, good. What is the outermost of those two layers?
Parietal.
Parietal, good. So the parietal is the outermost layer, the visceral is the innermost of the two layers. Now, which of these two is anchored to the fibrous pericardium?
Parietal.
Parietal, yeah. So if I were to raise this, I know you can probably see a little bit of the outline, right? Okay, let's actually draw this in. This number two layer here is your parietal layer. That number one layer is your visceral serous layer. Okay. And if we were to place the heart, where should the heart go? Inside, yes. So all this in here is your heart. Okay? And so, once again, the fibrous pericardium is actually an outermost layer. So let's drill that one in. I'm just going to take the chalk and kind of come around the outside. Okay, so to give you a mental image of how this works, I want you to think about double-sided gift wrap. Okay, you know, double-sided gift wrap, you can do it either way, it's reversible. That's how the fibrous layer and the parietal layer work. If I look from this direction, I'm looking at the fibrous pericardium. If I peel it back and look at the other side, I'm now looking at the parietal serous pericardium. So it just depends on my perspective, which side I'm looking at. Now, between all serous membranes is a very thin layer of what? Serous fluid. Yeah, so right in between here, that's where we're going to find our serous fluid. And what is the function of that fluid? Good, reduces friction. So we're just going to add that in. Okay, and in fact, that serous fluid is called pericardial fluid. And it creates a space between your visceral layer and your outer parietal layer. So let's say that we're taking a sample of the pericardial fluid. What layers must we pierce through with a needle to sample that pericardial serous fluid? Good. Fibrous and then parietal. Do we need to go as deep as that visceral layer?
No.
No, because by that point we've already hit that serous fluid, right? Okay. Any questions on the three layers covering the outside of the heart? Okay, so from superficial to deep, we first encounter fibrous pericardium. Next, we encounter parietal, which is a serous membrane. And then finally, we encounter a layer called the visceral serous pericardium. Okay, so fibrous, parietal, and visceral. Okay, so if we turn our perspective a different way, we can actually talk about the walls of the heart itself. So when we start talking about the heart itself, the outermost layer is called the epicardium. And you say, whoa, wait a minute, you just called it the visceral layer. Well, it depends on our perspective. If our perspective is the layer of membranes around the heart, yeah, you could call it the serous membrane visceral layer. But if now we're talking about the actual heart as an organ and we've cut into it, we can call it the epicardium. So my take-home message is this. I would know that visceral, pericardium, and epicardium are the same layer. Okay? So that way you can interchange those terms when needed. No matter what you call it, visceral or epicardium, it is the outermost layer of the heart directly anchored to a layer of muscle. What's the muscle of the heart called?
Myocardium.
Myocardium, good. And do you recall what type of muscle this is?
Cardiac muscle.
Cardiac muscle, good. So let's go fast forward here for just a moment. That myocardium is meant to be a pumping portion of the heart. You'll notice that it is cardiac muscle. What do you remember about cardiac muscle tissue? Good. Striated, intercalated discs.
Branching.
What's that?
Branching.
Branching. Good. Voluntary or involuntary?
Involuntary.
Yeah, involuntary. And there's something about these branches. You'll notice these cells tend not to touch, and that's because when a nerve impulse travels through them, those cells branch. The nerve impulse branches, and that way we can hit one spot immediately, and those cells can all contract as a unit. We do not want the nerve impulse to go zapping sideways into different areas because then that area may contract with us and we really don't intend for that extra area to contract together with us. So yeah, there's something about this branching pattern, but yet separate cells in this cardiac muscle tissue. Something else I did want to mention, these muscle cells are amitotic at maturity. What does that mean about them? They cannot regenerate. Yeah, they can't divide, they can't regenerate. If someone has heart muscle tissue damage, say from a heart attack, there's nothing you can do, right? Okay, so right now the science has not progressed to the point that we can repair heart muscle tissue. What happens to replace that damaged heart muscle tissue? Scar tissue. Yeah, what is scar tissue made of? Collagen, right. And collagen doesn't play well with other muscle tissue. It doesn't contract and shorten when it's told to do so. And it's also a very tough, strong type of fiber. So unfortunately, scar tissue in the heart is not good for heart muscle contraction. Interesting stuff out there on the horizon. They've actually played with implanting stem cells into heart muscle tissue that's been damaged, and they've watched the heart muscle tissue regenerate. That is fantastic news for someone who has had heart muscle tissue damage, say from multiple heart attacks. So, hey, maybe that'll be the wave of the future.
They're actually, my son is born with a heart defect, and at UNSC, there's actually where they can do a 4D, like take a picture of his heart, not like cut him open or anything, but they can actually do that now, and 5 years ago they couldn't.
Wow.
So it's coming a long way. And there's actually overseas, there's, I don't know where, but they're actually growing hearts off of leaves. Like
off of leaves, wow.
And they can literally, like, there's a beat that's going like this.
Wow.
Yeah.
So no more heart transplant list, just grow your own and there you go.
Well, they're trying to figure out some simple way to help, you know, kids like
myself. That's fantastic. And I've heard they can also do a 3D printer copy of the heart after they scan it, and then they can manipulate how they want to do surgery before they ever cut.
Yeah, well, now it's 4D.
4D,
now
so.
Now they can flip it.
That is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, when they're going in for surgery, it's going to be hopefully done right. Yeah. Let's see. I did want to mention a couple of things to you since we were talking about heart layers from the outside in. Let's repeat one more time the layers starting from the outside. In fact, it's peeled back here, so you don't see the fibrous pericardium. You see the piece anchored to it, which is? Parietal. Yep, that's parietal there for letter A. And there's a space here, you might see it. That's where the fluid is housed. And what is letter B anchored to the heart?
Visceral.
Yeah, that's visceral pericardium. Good. The other name for visceral pericardium?
Epicardium.
Good. So we can see at least that much from the outside. And this is a really good picture because you can see the space there between those two pericardial layers. I would like to mention an issue, though, with that pericardial sac. If there's an instance where excess fluids accumulate between the fiber or the parietal and visceral layers, you can end up with a disorder called cardiac tamponade. And I hate to tell you, but a lot of these heart disorders have multiple names. This one's also called heart plug and pericardial effusion. I'll tell you a real easy way to remember this, though. What do tampons do? Soak up fluid, right. So if you've got cardiac tamponade, we'd like to have a tampon to soak up your excess fluid. Now, people have surgery. They may have blood or pus or excess fluid accumulate between the layers. It may be, in fact, cancer or other issues, you know, surgically related, that can cause extra fluid to build up between those two pericardial membranes. If that's the case, one way to get rid of that extra fluid is to insert a syringe between the visceral and the parietal layers and extract it out. So how do you think somebody would feel with extra fluid around the heart?
Tired, sluggish.
Heavy breathing.
Hurts to breathe.
Hurts to breathe, yes. Let's see how right we are. Yeah, there you go. Chest pain, difficulty breathing. Lightheaded, goodness, blue skin would definitely be something for it. So, yeah, these would all cause emergency signals that would probably send someone to an emergency room trip. So, best way to do for this is to get that fluid off that heart. All right, just checking to see if anybody still needs a slide. Okay. Let's see, down near the bottom of your page, I just want to mention pericarditis and endocarditis. Pericarditis, as the word is broken down, means inflammation of what?
Pericardium,
right. Now, this is different from cardiac tamponade because when you inflame tissues, what happens to them? They swell, yeah. So instead of gliding and sliding back and forth like they should, the visceral and parietal pericardia are swollen and they rub past one another. This can come from infection, especially from something like pneumonia. The pneumonia can travel from the lungs. It can hit the pericardial sac of the heart. And now we've got inflammation around the heart. So notice here, we're not dealing necessarily with excess fluid accumulation. More, it's a case of inflamed and rubbing pericardial membranes. So reduce the inflammation, whether it's through a medication that reduces inflammation, or get rid of the root cause of the infection, and the pericarditis should follow suit. All right, what is inflamed during endocarditis? Good. So this is a bacterial infection. You can see the pus accumulating there on the heart valves. And this is an actual picture of endocarditis. You may notice something that looks like sores inside the heart. You know, I know how painful a sore is in my mouth. Could you imagine having one inside your heart? You know, so bacterial infections can set up here inside the heart. Rheumatic fever, scarlet fever, things of that sort can set up here. This is one very good reason not to let strep throat go untreated. You know, a lot of times we say, oh, it's okay, it's a sore throat. If it's strep, it can get into your heart. It can also affect your kidneys. So it can cause endocarditis that way. All right, that is it for page 35. How about questions there? So, you know, our magic number for hemoglobin was 4, okay? And our magic number for the heart is going to be 4. There's 4 chambers and 4 valves here. And the whole issue of having a heart is to increase pressure and push the blood through our vessels. And we do that by having chambers and valves that are making sure that blood is shunted from one location to the next and not prevented to backflow. Some animals have 3 chambered hearts, but we're more sophisticated with 4 because that keeps our oxygenated blood on the left side separated from our deoxygenated blood on the right side. All right, so let's take the 2 superior chambers first. Those 2 most superior chambers here are called atria, okay? And if we refer to them as a single chamber, we should call them an atrium. And I make that point because if you write on a test question, write atria, then technically you're referring to multiple chambers. So the correct answer should be what?
Atria.
Atrium, exactly. So these chambers here, right atrium and left atrium, receive blood from the body under low pressure. Let's talk about the veins that feed blood back into the right atrium. What is the name of this vessel? Good. And where is it bringing blood from? Yeah. Above the arm, or above the heart, arms and head come back into the SVC or superior vena cava. What about this vessel down here? Good. And where does it bring blood from? Yeah, everywhere below the heart, right? So abdomen, you know, legs, all those organs in there come back up in this IVC. Why is the SVC and IVC colored blue?
Deoxygenated.
Good. What does that mean? Yeah, very low oxygen levels. Good. Are there, in fact, blue vessels in your body? Good. So they've colored them blue just to help us keep them straight. Of course, you know, vessels are not blue in the body. If we cut one open, we don't see them that way. There is one more vessel that dumps back into the right atrium. What is that one? Yeah, coronary sinus. And it looks like an opening in this area here is going to be home to the coronary sinus. So it also brings back deoxygenated blood from your heart circulation itself. Let's see, left atrium gets blood from 4 veins. What are they called?
Pulmonary veins.
Good. And of course, the name pulmonary means
lungs.
Good. And these veins are bringing blood back to the heart. Now the catch is, are they blue or are they red? They should be red. Yeah, because in the heart, of course, there's an exception of two pulmonaries, right? So arteries are red, veins are blue. In the heart, there's an exception of two. Pulmonaries are going to be flip-flopped. So pulmonary veins, in fact, should be colored red. I don't know about this picture now. That looks a little bit blue, doesn't it? Yeah. So we've got our sets of veins taken care of, coming back into the right and left atria. Those blood molecules flow down through these open valves here. And now we're down into these pumping chambers known as the ventricles. So we have a left ventricle and a right ventricle. I want you to look closely and tell me which one looks more muscular.
The left.
Why the left?
Because it has to pump all the way.
Good. Has to pump out to the body. Good. Where does your right ventricle pump blood to? To the lungs. Good. Who has to have more pressure, right or left? The left side, yeah. So when we take blood pressure and you say, my blood pressure is 115 over 70, you're actually taking left side pressure. Had you been taking right side pressure, it'd be something like 24 over 8. So the pressure on the left side is like 4 to 5 times greater than right side pressure. And you're right, the evidence is in the muscle in those chambers. All right, so we say that the left side sends blood on a systemic circuit. That means the blood goes out to the body. And the right side sends blood on a pulmonary circuit, meaning what? To the lungs. Good. So left is systemic, right is pulmonary. Okay, got you a blank there in your paper there. The left ventricle sends oxygenated blood to the entire body. Do you know why the left ventricle is larger? Has to pump to the body. Yep, that works. There are walls that separate your two chambers. You can't see the interatrial wall because it's hidden by these blood vessels. The only way to imagine that interatrial septum is to look inside each of your atria. So if you look here, you can see a wall dividing the two. That wall should not be penetrated by any openings. Back before birth, you may have noticed there was an opening there called foramen ovale, right? And after birth, it seals up and is called fossa ovalis, right? So that's probably it right there. So unfortunately, that can cause problems if left open between left and right sides. This ventricle has, or these ventricles rather, have a wall separating them. What is the name of this one?
Interventricular septum.
Good. And it's mostly myocardium sitting there between those two walls. All right. So that should cover page 36. How about questions there? Right, page 37 is the valves of the heart. At the very top of the page, it says that these valves have one job, and that is to prevent the backflow of blood. Okay, so at no time will the four heart valves ever be open at the same time. You lose all pressure if you have all four heart valves open. There is, in fact, two instances where all four heart valves will be closed, and most of the time what they're doing is taking turns. One set open, another set closed, letting the blood flow through, and then flip-flopping. So this way the blood maintains pressure and, most importantly, stays high enough to pump out to the body. We have two sets of valves. We have an atrioventricular set that's situated between the right atrium and right ventricle, left atrium and left ventricle. So we can call them right AV and left AV valve for short, or what is the alternate name for the one on the right side?
Tricuspid,
good. How about the one on the left side? Or
mitral,
good. So the naming scheme here comes from the number of cusps or flaps that are involved. That right AV valve or tricuspid valve does have three pieces or flaps. There they are. And of course the bi means two, and there's two flaps there for that mitral valve. So those valves or flaps are going to be closed to prevent blood from backflowing from the ventricles into the atrium. We don't want it to go in that particular direction. The other set of valves are called semilunar valves. Those semilunar valves look like little half moons. I think the best way to describe them is to explain how a trap door works. If someone hides a trap door under a rug and you step on it, you're going to fall through the trap door. So only when blood pushes against these semilunar valves will they open. Otherwise, their job is to stay shut, just like a trap door. So each of them has three little flaps there. You can see them in both pictures. The one guarding the base of the aorta is called your aortic semilunar valve. You guys can call it SLV for short if you like. And you've got a pulmonary semilunar valve, or pulmonary SLV for short. So those two guard the base of those two large arteries leaving the heart. Just wanted to remind you, even though the pulmonary trunk is colored blue on our models, it is still an artery. It's carrying blood away from the heart. Okay. Any questions on the four valves? So all this conversation about blood flow, we forget the heart itself is an organ, and so let's talk about coronary circulation near the bottom of your page. So the heart is a muscle, and muscle tissue requires a lot of oxygenated blood to make ATP. So you wonder, how do we get the oxygenated blood? Well, the answer is we steal it from the aorta. So right here at the base of your aorta, you'll notice a couple of vessels branching off. On the heart models in lab, they look like two little red stumps of a blood vessel. So these are coronary arteries that branch and nourish the myocardium here on the front side. There's also a set of coronary arteries that branch and serve the back side of the heart. You know, normally when you think about blood vessels running through your body, you think about them running through the tissue, but not the case here. These vessels actually sit on the outer surface. You can see them simply by looking at the outer surface of the heart, both front and back. So as the heart contracts and pumps blood up through the aorta, the pressure then sends blood out through these coronary arteries. So that takes oxygenated blood to your myocardium. From that point, we exchange gases at the capillaries, and we send blood back by way of coronary veins. Coronary veins mostly dump blood into this major vessel on the backside of the heart. What is this one called? Yeah, the sinus. And for most of us, that's the blood flow pattern. Where does the coronary sinus end up dumping its blood? Back in the right atrium, right. So there's some variability here. Not everybody is constructed the same way. That's one of the benefits of getting to see those cats in lab, is to see that no two are really made exactly the same. So most of us have the drainage pattern of a coronary sinus picking up most of that blood. Others do not. So there is some construction variability there in the way that we're made. Okay, so I'd like to mention to you this issue of coronary bypass surgery. And this kind of surgery is a way for us to bypass a blocked vessel. Sometimes if you have, you know, a lot of plaque build up inside of a vessel, that plaque can rupture and the blood vessel can no longer deliver nutrients and oxygen to the myocardium. So if that is the case of having a blockage, we can take a vessel from elsewhere in your body, literally bypass that blocked area, and provide a new connection with blood flow to that myocardium. So the benefit is we can still give that myocardium oxygenated blood. There can be as few as a one-way bypass. There can be as many as a nine-way bypass. So they may estimate this patient's going to have a three or four-way. They may get in there and start looking, and they may end up doing a five or a six-way, depending on the blockages. So where do they get these vessels from that they do this bypass surgery with? Yeah, use your own leg vessels, right? So what is the benefit of using your own? No rejection, right. Is there a downside of using a vein where you're actually needing it to do an artery's job?
Smaller.
smaller, less muscular, wears out more quickly. So most bypass surgeries last 20 to 30 years. So if you've got a 40-year-old having bypass surgery, 70 years old, you're looking at those vessels having met the end of their life, and they may need to repeat the process. So yeah, there's advantages of using your own, and there's also disadvantages. They can strip and mine vessels from the arm. They can do mammary vessels as well, but the leg is a favorite place to pull out and use that vessel for this job. Okay, so I just wanted to remind you that there are two flow paths here. We just did coronary, but over on page 38, we're going to look at two flow pathways all linked in together. Keep in mind, when blood flows from the heart to the body and back to the heart, what do we call that flow pattern?
Systemic.
Good. What is the flow pattern to and from your lungs?
Pulmonary.
Good. What you've got on page 38 is both combined with heart flow. You've done this in lab, right? Okay, so nothing new here. That's actually going to be a guaranteed essay question on test number 2. All you have to do is just list out the structures through which blood will flow, and you don't have to indicate oxygenated or deoxygenated. I'll ask you that somewhere else on the test. Okay, so all you got to do is just list out those structures. Let me caution you, I may pick a random starting point. I've just got it started on that page as SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. I may say, okay, hey, let's start at the pulmonary trunk, or let's start at the left ventricle. So you want to realize this is just a loop pathway, and that no matter where you start, it is the same flow pattern. What's your comfort level with this blood flow pathway? Pretty good? Want to do it just for fun, or do you feel comfortable skipping it and moving on? For fun. We can do it for fun. Sure can. Okay. Let's just start the way it's written, SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus. They dump blood into the right atrium. Is that blood oxygenated or deoxygenated?
Deoxygenated.
Good. We now travel through an open valve. This one is called?
Tricuspid.
Good. Tricuspid valve. And we head down into the right ventricle. About that time, the right ventricle contracts, the valve shuts, and we pump blood up through this valve here known as?
Pulmonary
semilunar valve, or SLV for short. We now travel through a pulmonary trunk, and then where? To the pulmonary arteries. They branch into smaller vessels known as? And even smaller vessels?
Capillaries.
Good. And then we do gas exchange at the lungs at these capillaries. We're now heading back to the heart through pulmonary venules, and they dump into?
Veins.
Good. So this is oxygenated blood now being returned to the left atrium. And of course, from the left atrium, we travel through what valve? Good. What's another name for it?
Mitral
or?
Left
AV. Yep, so you got three names for that one. You can pick whichever you like to remember. We're now down to the left ventricle, and then up through another valve known as? Good, aortic semilunar valve. We are now heading out through the aorta. We're going for systemic circulation. What does the aorta branch into? And then?
Arterioles.
Good.
Venules.
Veins.
And then back to the heart. Yes, so SVC, IVC, coronary sinus. So it's about 20-some steps when you map it out. If you have not yet learned it, I highly recommend a picture or a model. I think sitting there with just the straight words is blah, it goes over the top of your head. But you know, if you've got a picture like one of these, I think that's a big help. All right, so why don't we do a break? Come back about 2:05, and then we're going to work a little more on heart, and then we'll transition to